Please help Feet First welcome our speaker this evening, Robbie S. from There Is a Solution in Barnegat, New Jersey. Robbie S., thank you for coming.
Wow. Hi, everyone. I'm Robbie. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Robbie.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Am I using this right now?
You are.
Here's the thing. I hate microphones. I hate them. I do not do them well. And So, because I usually walk back and forth, but I promised the group that I'm going to try my hardest to stay in one place and not walk all over and stay in front of the microphone so it can be recorded, but I might be over there in a little bit. Who knows? Am I not doing it right?
No,
am I good? Okay, can you still hear me? What a great group. So, I love coming out here. Every group has different energy, and I don't know what I'm going to say tonight, so forgive me if ahead of time. I always, of course, pray and I ask God to just remove me from the room tonight and remove my ego and to allow me to speak through Him. And and then I don't think about what I'm going to say. But let me just tell you, if I did, it'd be good stuff, right? Because sometimes in the shower or like laying in bed at night, I come up with really good stuff. And I think, oh, when I get to Quaker Town, I'm going to tell them about that, right? And then I get here and I ask God to, to let His word speak through me, and I don't know what comes out. So good luck to all of you. my friend Shane is here, and Jeff. And so I want to thank everybody that came out. I have a bunch of friends from Philly here, and Lori and Allison and Becky came in the car with me, and I thank you guys for coming out. I want to thank the group for inviting me, and Big Dave's not here. I know he's speaking at one of our meetings in Philly right now, but thank Eric and everybody from the group for having us out. For whoever made the coffee, I want to thank you for doing that. Thank Henry for bringing me coffee. I never met Henry before, but we're Facebook friends. We have all these mutual friends, and Henry brought me this big Dunkin' Donuts coffee, and I think, wow, people take good care of me. I don't know what that is. I just have really good people surrounding me all the time. It's amazing. So God separated me from alcohol on June 7th, 1997. And I tell you that because they tell us to qualify ourselves that way. It doesn't mean much to me. I don't know what it means to you. Hopefully not much at all. I heard somebody say one time, and I say it all the time myself, I'm not real impressed. That, you know, don't be impressed with my clean time. I'm not real impressed with most of yours. And I'm not, you know. Our clean time doesn't really mean anything. It's how we're living today, and you know, definitely. I suppose if I could have been recovered for 14 and a half years, I might be pretty cool, you know. But I was sick and suffering for a long time, and in fact, what time is it? It's 8:14. So I've got like 14 minutes of emotional sobriety right now, you know. So because ego comes in, and I'm a mess. So it's really. Not about how long we've been separated from alcohol, but how close we are to God and our Creator and to you. So, and I do talk about God when I speak a lot, and I hope that I don't offend anybody. the book tells us that we need not ever apologize for God. And the book tells us that we tell you in our personal stories, our personal venture of finding God. And that's what I'm here to do tonight, tell you about how I got here. I'll tell you a little bit about how it was and what happened and what it's like now, for sure, and how my journey to God has been so far. I have a sponsor, and he's really cool. And he has a sponsor, and I sponsor women, and the women I sponsor other women. And sometimes, I'm really old, so sometimes those women sponsor the women, and those women sponsor other girls, and it's really cool. And this whole fellowship just grows up amongst us, and we create that fellowship that we crave, that the book talks about. And, you know, we're talking on the way up, you know, just, you know, raising girls in Alcoholics Anonymous and bringing them through the book and in the solution so that we have more women out there sponsoring. And it's definitely the shining point of my life. I will start out with telling you that the shining point of my life is definitely you, all you girls. You know what I mean? It's really, I've got beautiful twin daughters. They're 13 years old and they're the light of my life. And then, than the girls that I get the honor and privilege of working with and seeing a transition happen in them. You know what I mean? Like, when I see another woman come in here and she's broken down to the ground and she's beaten up and this is her last stop on the block. This is her last house. So there's nowhere else to go and she's broken and she can't look you in the eye and she's sick and she's suffering and she's hurting and she's in pain. And you see that transformation start to happen, right? And the light bulb starts to go off a little bit and she starts to look you in the eye and she's glowing a little bit. And that's the miracle, right? That's what keeps me coming around. That's what fires me up. That's what gets me up every day. I have purpose today. That is my purpose in life, is to, you know, I'm not here to get well anymore. I'm here to help you get well so you can help other people get well, you know? And when I see that happen, and then sometimes I see that happen, you know, I see a girl completely transform right in front of my very eyes. And that's not her and that's not me, it's God. And then sometimes that girl, I'll be leaving a meeting and I'll see her in the parking lot with a book open and she'll be helping another girl and she'll be talking to her. She'll start a woman's big book meeting and she'll be helping other people take, and that's the beautiful thing that we're doing here. That's what I can't ever even talk about without tearing up, right? Because that's what AA is all about for me. That's my experience anyway. So, you know, AA is a language of love, right? And I always ask when I pray before I speak that, that your ears be attached to your heart, you know, and my mouth be attached to my heart, and so that we can speak the language of love, which is a language of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think I qualify myself. Oh, my home group is, There Is a Solution. It's in Barnegat, New Jersey, as was mentioned. We meet on Saturdays at 8 o'clock. And if you're ever in the area, please come by. We're right down by the beach, by LBI. And it's a great group. It's just like this, an hour speaker meeting with a microphone and all. I'm still talking in this thing. It's amazing. we bring speakers in from all over the country. And it's an exciting group. There's a huge pocket of enthusiasm up there in New Jersey, and like you guys have here. So we'd love to come together in unity and share. You know, so if you're in the area, let me know. Get my number after the meeting. They give me the honor and privilege to have a service position within that home group, and that always amazes me, right? Like, they trust me to show up and to be in service for them, and they give me that you know, they say that the highest ranking position you can have in Alcoholics Anonymous is to be a servant. And it's a pretty cool thing. You know, it's an honor and privilege to be here tonight. I'm always amazed that you guys keep letting me come here, and your code is love and tolerance. Like, that's pretty cool, right? Like, it's like, All my life spent in so much hate and ickiness and ugliness, and you didn't even let me there. But you guys practice this love and tolerance, and you let me show up and be in service, and so I thank you for that. Okay, so a little bit about what it was like, I guess. We qualify ourselves, I believe, when we come out to talk, so that you can identify, you know. And so I will tell you a little bit about what it was like. I started drinking when I was 12 years old, had my first drink. And I always say, I know that's a little late for some of you guys. some of you guys are sitting there thinking she's a late bloomer. But I grew up on a farm in Bucks County, and this wasn't offered to me. As soon as it was offered, I took it, and I ran with it for many years. And that's all I can tell you. You know, it's the same story that you all have. It's just that sense of ease and comfort that came over me with the first drink. I was definitely, like you, irritable and restless and discontent from the gate. I was absolutely miserable. I was so uncomfortable, just so freaking uncomfortable. And some of you guys relate, right? Like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, just being, before that first drink, just being so uncomfortable with who you are, where you are, with who you're standing with right here, right now, not okay with it, just uncomfortable. I grew up with a really, really, really great family. I got to tell you, I would not do justice to my family if I did not tell you that they're amazing people, right? Amazing people. And And I was irritable and restless and uncomfortable and discontented. And, you know, and earlier when I identified myself as a recovered alcoholic, you know, the book tells us to do so. And also I don't do justice to my higher power, my creator, if I don't tell you that I've been able to recover from this. You know, it's not cured. I'm not cured. I'm in remission. But I've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. I have, right? So, and that's the truth for me right now today. I'm not irritable, restless, and discontent. I can look you in the eye. I can show up. I do not mistreat my children or you, and I do not think that a drink is a good idea. I do not think that putting a drink in my body is a very good idea at all. That thought does not come to me, and that's what we talk about when we're recovered from that hopeless state. So, can you still hear me if I'm back here?
Yeah.
Okay. Nice. I can't stand here in the microphone. Can you hear me in the back? Yeah, all of you? Yeah? I just do that, see if they're listening in the back. I do it now and again. So I was so uncomfortable, and what happened was I just didn't know how to fit in. I had no sense of belonging, but I had a deep, deep desire for one. You know what I mean? That hunger and thirst that we have for a spiritual way of living that we do not know about, you know, until we get here and we discover it. I had that hunger and thirst to feel like I fit in and to belong, but I just didn't. And that's just because I didn't know what I suffered from. I would not know what I suffered from for a very, very long time. And I would not know what I was suffering from until I found you and you told me about it. You know, and God bless my mother. She did not know what I suffered from either. she was a good mom, and she the only thing she did was love me, you know, unconditionally, no matter what. She just couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And so she'd send me away. She'd send me to different places. From my first drink on, I kind of ran with it, like I said. And so my mom would send me to different homes for runaway girls and homes for troubled teens. And sometimes they were eating disorder rehabs, and I was anorexic. I was anything I could to get outside of me, that spiritual malady, anything I could to get out of what's icky in here, that uncomfortability in here. I'm going to do anything. So if it's men, sex, shopping, you know, throwing up everything I eat, just whatever I can do, I'm going to keep doing it to try to figure out how to get comfortable, and I can't. And so my mom's sending me everywhere she can. I would just break away. I'd run away. She'd send me to places and with bars in the windows and whatnot, and I would just run away and I'd come home. She always said the only way to get Robbie to come home is to put her in a lockup facility, because then she'd run away and comes home. And that's what I did for a long time. I remember my mom saying one time at the kitchen table, I overheard her saying, "There's no use." She told my father, "There's no use. She'll just die out there. There's no use at this point. We give up." And she said, "Let's just give up." And she said, "She'll die. She'll probably get pregnant and raped, and she'll die out in the street somewhere. And I'd probably come home from a run and try to take a break at home." And so at 15, I got pregnant and had my first baby, and I got married. And what happened was I had this little baby girl. Her name was Cassandra. We call her Cassie. She's beautiful, and she was gorgeous. And so now here I am searching for a home, looking for love, uncomfortable, completely out of my mind, and suffering from something that some of you may suffer from. I don't know. But I suffered from this thing called self-pity, right? Because it's all about me. It's self, self, self. And the book tells us that we must be rid of selfishness or it will kill us. It's because the drink's not killing us. It's that self-centeredness that's killing us. It's the self-pity. It's the inability to be able to look at me and see my part in it, right? Clearly, I can't see my part in it. I've not swallowed big truths about myself yet. I've not done a fourth and fifth step. All I know is that you've completely abused me, and everybody has just taken advantage of me my whole life. And all I want is love, but nobody will give it to me. And that's how I feel. So, you know, and again, like I said, I came from this great family, right? But where would I end up? I'd end up in the streets of Trenton and in the streets of Newark and the streets of New York City. And I'd live out in the streets for long periods of time. And I would figure out how to run the streets, and they would teach me. And I was comfortable there. The book says that we seek out the most sordid of places to find companionship and approval, right? And that it works, but only momentarily. And that was me, right? So I'm out in the streets. I suffer from self-pity, and I got to go. I always got to go. And I just got to go. There's something in me that's got to go. I'm not good here. And and so I always have to go. And what happened was when I was living out in the streets, they would tell me these stories about these awful lives that they had. And I thought, God, that's horrible. So I would tell you the same kind of story, but it wasn't true. Right? So I just made up lies so that I could fit in. So I'm always reinventing myself and telling you new things about who I am. It's like in the witness protection program, right? Like I'm always got, like, here's my new file. I'm going to go to new work and tell them that my dad beats me and it's horrible. And please let me stay around this trash can tonight and sleep on your park bench. And why? You know, I don't know. Like I didn't know what I suffered from again. And my family didn't know, but you guys seem to kind of, like, okay, we get it. You know what I mean? And the book talks about, you know, that sometimes we're able to be truthful with ourselves, and the truth that we find is that we had no idea why we did it. And that was me. I was as baffled as they were. I had no idea why I did it. You know, people would say she's a nice girl. She comes from a nice family. Why does she live out in the street? She's a nice girl. She comes from a nice family. Why doesn't she go home and she has a nice place to sleep and she has a nice husband. She's got two beautiful kids. Why doesn't she go home? And I didn't know either. You know, I didn't know either. I figured I was probably schizophrenic or had some kind of serious mental disease. They laugh because they think I still am. And those are my friends that laugh, by the way. So, you know, I just think that, you know, I don't know. I don't know why I do. I just do it. At this point in my life, now I'm 15, 16 years old. I just drink every day because that's what I do. I get up and I drink. That's what I do. And I hear people talking about why they drank and to get out of this and that and to feel better and to fit in with the boys and stuff like that. I just drank because I drank. I drank because at a very early age, I drank because I was sick if I didn't. You know what I mean? And they say, like, being alcoholic isn't because you drink whenever you want. It's when we drink when we don't want to. You know what I mean? That moral convictions galore. Like, I had that. Like, I would wake up and I would say to myself, God damn, you know that you wake up with that shame and remorse and guilt just on you, and you just can't believe what you did the night before, and you just it feels so icky, and you just think, oh, the only thing I can do is just not drink today, and that's what I would do. I'd wake up and say, today I'm going to be a good mom, and I'm going to do that thing the other moms do. I see them out at the park, and they're playing with their kids. They don't do that. See, I come to at some point, and I figure out where they are. But today I'm going to get up, and I'm going to go take care of them. I'm going to take the kids to the park, and I'm going to be one of those good moms. And I'm going to be a faithful wife for the first time. I'm going to stop doing the way I'm doing, and I am going to promise him that I'll quit drinking, and I'll be faithful, and I'll stay home tonight. And I could not do it for a day. Moral convictions galore. It did nothing for me. I wanted to. I just couldn't do it. And I gave birth to this little girl, Cassandra, on October 16th, and she was beautiful. And I thought, now I'm going to be a mom, and I'm going to have somebody that loves me unconditionally no matter what all the time. And I'm going to love her, and it's going to be beautiful. And I'm going to show her a way of life that they never showed me. Like I had it so bad, right? And I'm going to give her all this love. And what happened was I just took her hostage. I took her with me all over the country. I would just run. I had to go all the time. I'd take her with me. We end up in trailers in Florida with no gas, no electricity, sleeping in cars and panhandling for money and outside of Circle K's and stuff like that and using her to try to get money. And what happened was I'd get in angry fits of rage and was abusive. I neglected her and left her alone. You know, her grandparents kidnapped her. I called it kidnapping. They kidnapped her one time, which meant that they took her out of my home to put her in a safe home. And I was so mad they kidnapped my daughter. I went there and banged in the doors and windows in the middle of the night, and I stole her back. And I said, you had no right to take my baby from me. And they said, we were protecting her from you. And I said, she doesn't need protection. They said, I went into her crib to check on her and to feed her, and she wasn't there. You don't have a right to take my baby. And they said, when do you go into the crib? I said, just now. I came right over I saw she was missing. They said, Robin, it's Tuesday. We took her Friday. Right? That's where alcohol takes me. I wouldn't have taken care of her for 4 days. I wouldn't have known it. That's where alcohol takes me from. I'll do this beautiful little baby girl. I'll give my life for, don't know where she is for 4 days. You know, she's 5 months old. So And at some point, my husband was in the military, and they asked me to leave the military base. They said I was no longer welcome. They said that they had a place for me. I'd gotten in some trouble, and my girls had been in serious harm's way. And I'd come out of a blackout, and it was not a good situation. And the military said to me that I could go to a place that they had that would help me, or I would have to leave the Air Force base, and I'd have to leave the children behind. And I looked at my husband, and I said to him, could I borrow the car then? Right? Again, that's where alcohol takes me. I want to love them. I want to stay with them. I don't know when I'll have choice and drink at this point. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what I'm suffering from, but I know I got to go because I don't even hear that option about getting well. I just know that somebody's trying to interfere with what I do, with the solution I have for living, and they're trying to take that away from me. So the rest of the story really doesn't carry a lot of depth and weight. For many years, I just ran. When you'd meet me out in the streets, I'd tell you about how I was this, bless you, I'd tell you about how I was this, this free-spirited gypsy, and I didn't really have a home because I was just this gypsy living in the land, and I was a homeless junkie drunk. That's what I was, and that's what I was, right? And I don't even know what I am, right? So we come in here, and when I do my first, fourth, and fifth step, what I understand finally for the first time is who I am, so I can get rid of it, right? In 6 and 7, I can't get rid of it because I don't know who I am. I've been lying to you for so long. I have no idea who I am. And I've been telling stories and making up lies and running away and I'm so full of shame and remorse and guilt. I have no idea. And I come in here and you tell me about this and I do some inventory and look at it and what I find out is that was me, right? Because I didn't know who I was. I couldn't get rid of me. I couldn't abandon myself from me until I saw who I was. And you guys taught me that. So for many years, I would continue to just travel, to just go from one place to the next. And it wasn't pretty. It wasn't great. There were some times I woke up in Vegas, married to a guy I'd met the night before in a bar. It was a good time. So I'm not going to lie. There were some good times in there. You know what I mean? But I'd have to go. You know, and I have to go. He controlled my drinking or, you know, something. It's just, I'd have to go. And I just felt so sorry for myself and that shame, remorse, and guilt from having left the kids and stuff like that. And I tell you about how my kids were stolen from me, but I gave them up for a drink. I gladly sold them for a drink, right? So the spiritual malady now is growing, right? And I believe that the spiritual malady that is our alcoholism that we come in with. You know, I know I crossed an invisible line at some point. It's probably very early on in my drinking that I crossed that invisible line. What happened, though, was as I sold my soul for the next drink, the spiritual malady grows and becomes bigger and bigger, right? And now there's no more... There's nothing left to give. There's no more dignity in what I'm doing, right? So I have just sold my soul for the drink, and it's now hollow, and that spiritual malady has grown. And I come in here, bless you, and I come in here, and you taught me about that, you know, and you taught me about the allergy and the obsession and how the problem centers in our mind. And you told me about how I drank for the fact, right? So we drank for the fact of produced by it, right? I used to go to places like this out in parks where they have these big bonfires and everybody drinking kegs of beer. And I would take all the red cups and I'd pour them all into one. There'd just be a little bit left. I'd pour it all into one so I could drink it, so I could just get well enough to you know, find the next drink. And that's not drinking for the taste of it. Right, that's what we're talking about, drinking for the produce affected by it. And so I had the gift of desperation January 6, 1997, and at this point in my life I'm 24 years old. I just did the math now, you guys know how old I am. I'm 24 years old, and I'm a childless mother, motherless child. I'm a seventh grade dropout. I can't get my mom to speak to me to save my life. I ended up one time out where she lived out west, and I got to her house, and I thought it would get safe, and I was came to from a blackout in a rest stop out west somewhere. I didn't know where I was, so I went to her house, and I thought my mom will take me in, and she'll help me out, and she'll give me a warm meal and bed and a shower. And I got to the house, and she was in the window, and she was doing dishes, and she saw me, and I thought, thank God, I'm going to be safe in a minute, right? And my mom saw me, and she went down to the front door, and she locked it. And she continued to go around the house and lock every window in the house. I hitchhiked to a town, and I used a payphone. I called my little sister, and I said, can you just let me in the back door? And she said, no. Mom says, we're not safe when you're around. Mom says, we got to get out of town when you're around. And so that could have been a bottom for a heavy drinker. I don't know. You know, when they said, it's the kids or quit drinking. Somebody quit drinking. I don't know. I believe that I had no choice. So what happened was that wasn't a bottom for me. I ran for a lot of years after my mom locked that door, after they took the kids. In fact, right out, and I'm going to finish this story. I don't like going too much into this, but right after that incident where my mom locked the doors, I called my ex-husband. First, I panhandled for some money out of Circle K, but I couldn't get enough. It's really hard panhandling for money in the mountains of Idaho, I got to tell you. Like, it's not like Newark and New York where I'm used to. I'm outside. This town's like 300 people. Everybody knows everybody. There's Rita's daughter. And panhandling for money, you know, like, it's not easy. So anyway, some guys picked me up, and I did whatever they told me to do for a drink for a while, and I finally escaped from there. And I called my ex-husband, and I lied to him. I told him I was sober. I didn't know what that meant. I quit drinking, I told him, and could I come home and see my baby girls, and could just take care of me? And he said, sure. Send you a bus ticket. Western Union gave me a bus ticket, and I got on the bus, and I was so excited to see my baby girls. It'd probably been years, I have no idea. And I couldn't wait to see my baby girls. I'm all excited, and I'm on this bus, and I'm telling everybody, I got the whole bus on my side, you know, and we're going from Washington State down to Florida, and I'm telling them how I'm going to go see my baby girls any second, and I come to in Memphis, Tennessee, and I asked some people where it was, and they told me, and I called my husband from a payphone collect, and I said, I'm sorry, the bus broke down, you know, this whole story, because, again, I lie, and I can lie about my self-pity. I felt really sorry for myself that the bus broke down, you know, I'm believing this story, and I tell him, you know, I'm sorry the bus broke down, and I'll be there soon, and he says, Robbie, that was 3 days ago, you're not coming back here again, and I had every intention of getting off that bus and getting there, but I, you know, somewhere along the way, I'm sure somebody offered me a drink. And I come to days later in a state not on the way. And I don't know how I got there, and I know that I can't go home again. So now my mom's locked the doors, and the husband shut me out, and the kids are gone. And I don't know, you know, what else to do. So what happens is sometimes we don't know that God's all we need until God's all we got. Right? I wake up one day. I come to one day, and I'm sick, right? So at this point in my drinking, I'm sick, and to get the alcohol down my throat, it's not easy sometimes. It hurts. It comes up, and the things bleed in my throat, and I got to force the drinking, and I wake up, and what I do is I come to, and I go get myself a drink. That's what I do, right? Do you guys relate? Do you remember that? Like, that's what we do. We just drink, right? And what happened was, on this particular morning, it was January 6th, I don't know why, I woke up, I came to in a place, and I believe South Philly, I'm not sure, and I can't explain what happened, except for I don't know that I said God, because I don't know that I ever said the word God in my life. But I looked up and I said, please don't let me die. I don't want to die. See, for a lot of years, I wanted to die. I just didn't have the nerve and courage to do it. I knew it would be best for my kids, my mom, and most everybody else. And I had the courage to take my life. But I wanted to die, at least keep me comatose. And what happened was I came to, and instead of just going to do what I had to do to get a drink, I was scared to death. And I knew I was going to die. And I said, God, just don't let me die. Help me, please. And what happened was, in an event of circumstances, which, by the way, was like me calling like an operator and saying, I think I'm going to die. She's like, this is just the operator. Like, we don't do that here. Like, I'm like, well, I don't know who else to call. And she eventually transferred me to a hospital, and the hospital said, you are going to die. Anyway, eventually, you know, I was naked, and I had no car, nothing on me. I didn't know, I had nothing. And eventually, somebody at Living Green got me into the detox, and they brought me in, put a blanket around me. I said, I'm scared. I started to run out and cry. And they said, what are you scared of? And I said, I'm scared because it looks like a hospital in there. And they said, it is. It's a hospital for the terminally ill, and you're going to die. And I had jaundice, you know, and I had yellow, and my liver was coming out of my stomach, and I was sick, and I was dying, and spiritually I was been dead a long time. And so at some point in the game, what happened was I asked God for help that morning, and he brought me to you, right? And then you brought me to God. I can't connect with God directly. I'm too blind. I don't know anything about a God, but you brought me to God. So I asked God for help, and he brought me to you. He brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous and a wonderful woman. At some point, while I was still a little suffering and sick in the rooms, she came to me and she helped. She brought me through this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, her beautiful book, and she brought me through the 12 steps, and she brought me to a spiritual awakening, and she brought me to God, and then I connect with you, God's children, every day, and that's how we keep connected and hooked up. So what happened was divine intervention, I believe, again, I come out of rehab, detox, and you all gave me a place to sleep, and you let me sleep on your couches, and you brought me to meetings, and you bought me coffee. And for that, I'm internally grateful. I don't know how to be grateful enough for that, right? I don't know how to be. I can show up here and talk for an hour. This certainly doesn't seem like enough to give back, right? I can sit down with a new girl across the kitchen table and do everything that I can through God to help her get this and experience God herself. And I can do anything that Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to do, but I'll never be able to give it back. I'll never be able to give back what you gave to me, right? I can't. You can't outlove God. I can't outlove AA. You know, my goal is to just keep giving it back. You guys, you showed up for me. You let me sleep in your couches, and you took me to meetings, and I gave birth to these beautiful little twin girls early on in recovery. And what you did was you showed up. I'm scared to death, right? So I'm coming out of rehab. I'm coming to my first meetings and whatnot, and I'm an asshole. You guys don't like me, right? Like, I'm not nice, and I'm angry, and I'm pissed off, and I'm like, I won't let you have the coffee. I'm like standing in front of coffee, like trying to fight with you so that you couldn't take coffee because I just needed somebody to fight with. And you're all calm and serene. You don't want to fight, and I don't get it. And see, you would just keep giving me love. And I didn't know anything about it. And I would just act out more with anger and violence because it was the only way I knew to express to you that I was scared and frightened. I was a frightened, scared little girl. And I didn't. I needed you to show me how to grow up and show me how to show up for this thing. And you did, right? And then I gave birth to these little twin girls. And I'm in the hospital, and their father's got a needle in his neck under the aisle in Kensington, and I'm in the hospital giving birth. And I'm scared, and the nurse comes in and says, I've never seen so many people waiting to see a baby. And she said, I'm not kidding. We had to open up a different waiting room because Alcoholics Anonymous showed up, you know, and Cocaine Anonymous, where I also went to at the time. And you all just showed up, and you told me you don't have to do this alone, right? And I believed you, and I believed something had changed you. And that's all I had to do, is believe that something had changed you, that you believed in a power greater than yourself, and that you had a transformation. Again, when we go back to, I can't see the transformation in me like I can see in you guys. And I could see it in you then, and you just showed up for me, and that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We show up for each other with love, and you know, that's the beam, that's love. You know, my friend Jessica here in the back, she gave birth to a little baby girl, Nikki Ray, right? It's not really her name, it's what I call her. And and when was that, Jess? Like 10 months? 10 months ago. And what happened was, because of what you showed me, I was able to show up for Jessica and be there in the delivery room when she had her baby. And she wasn't alone, right? Because you taught me that. You taught me show up and be there for the other people, right? Everywhere I've ever looked around through all the corners and turns and trials and whatnot through the last 14 years, I look up and I see your faces. You're all there in every one of them. You know what I mean? The book says that if we follow the dictates of a higher power and we walk hand in hand with a new man, that we can presently live in a new and wonderful world regardless of our present circumstances, right? And it tells us if we fail to expand upon our spiritual life that we will not be able to handle the certain trials that are to come, right? So the certain trials are to come. In 14 years, Italia is great and beautiful and everything's been perfect and peachy, and that'd be easy stuff, right? But the trials have come and you've showed up. You helped me get connected with God. And through these steps in 10, 11, 12, I stay connected in prayer and meditation. And so what happens is, you know, we already talked about the fourth and fifth step, and so I'm kind of all over this place with that. But this lady, I said to her, I said, can you help me get my kids back? I go to this woman's meeting. I said, can you help me get my kids back? And she said, we can't. She finally said, Ron, we're sick of you asking. We can't help you get your kids back. She said, but what I can do is help you live with the fact you might not ever. And we can help you live with put your head on the pillow at night without shame, remorse, and guilt. And really, that's all I wanted. All I wanted was to be alone in perfect peace and ease. I didn't know anything about it. But that's what I wanted deep down inside. I wanted a home, right? We talked about this earlier, which I found in you. I wanted love, which I found in you and God. And I wanted to be alone in perfect peace and ease. And I didn't know about it, but you told me you could show me how to get there. So I said I was willing to do whatever you told me. And you told me I had a choice. Right? This woman told me I had a choice. She told me I could be doomed in alcoholic death and die the way I was living, or I could accept spiritual help. Do you know how blessed we are to have a choice? Like, I think, like, you know how many people we buried through the years? And I'm sure every person in this room has buried somebody probably recently. We bury a lot of men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And can you imagine how many don't even get here? How many don't even get the choice that we get into, that we can accept spiritual help? You know what I mean? That's why we get up every day with purpose and enthusiasm and passion and about the purpose of going out there and helping people have a choice. You can't make a decision to turn your life over and to the care of God if you've never given a choice. And so we make a decision to do that. And my sponsor, she told me about what that was like to give my life over to the care of God, right? And what that means. And I'm not running the show anymore. And that there's a power greater than myself that's my Father. And I can't do anything without Him, right? So I hit my knees. Our friend Vance talks about I hit my knees every day so that I start out my day with saying, I can't do this alone. That's what I'm doing on my knees, is saying I can't do it alone. But I want to perform your work well. And I understand I've taken on a new employer, and so I'm here. Fill me up. Do what you want with me, right? I want to be so close to God that you have to seek Him to find me, right? And so this is what I do every day. I try to keep in that conscious contact with God every day in the mornings and prayer and throughout the day, this conscious contact all the time. But they taught me about that in step three. I didn't know anything about it, but I know that when I did the third step prayer with my sponsor, my niece, that Memorial Day weekend, that something changed in me. And that's just my experience. And then when I was done, she told me I had to go bear witness. I said, that sounds really serious. I don't know about that. I thought I was just giving my life to God. And she said that I'm to go out and bear witness of the love and the power and the way of life, right? It means I come and tell you about the way of life, about the love, right? And that seems like a pretty big responsibility. And that I take seriously. You know, I think we're having a good time in AA. If you're not having a good time in AA, I don't know what you're doing. Like, get hooked up somewhere. Do something different. We're having a good time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, but I take bearing witness to my higher power and God and love and this way of life very seriously when I'm here. And we talked about swallowing big truths about myself and looking that I'm selfish and inconsiderate and dishonest, and I'm a self-seeking individual, and everything's been about me my entire life, and I've never thought about you. It says that our very lives depend upon the constant thought of others, and I never thought about you once. How am I going to do that, right? So now I have to bring these thoughts of you into my life in order to get rid of me. And then... You know, after seven-step prayer and asking for some defects and to all be removed, and I get to go out and make amends. And this I love talking about, and I hate that it's only an hour, because I always want like an hour and 5 minutes. I'm such an alcoholic. So, but you tell me I get to go out and make amends, right? And of course I'm not excited about it at the time, but I go out there and I make amends. And I go find my baby sister, and I like to tell you about this, because, you know, what we're doing is we're cleaning up the wreckage of our past for them. We're not doing it for ourselves. We're not, it tells us we have to do this to stay sober, right? But we're doing it for them. We've caused some damage. I've caused some damage out there. I need to go make right however I can. So when I go out there, I find my little baby sister, and I says, I robbed you of your peace and serenity your whole life. I robbed you of any attention you could have ever gotten. I needed attention desperately. Every minute I needed attention, I took that from you. Mom and Dad never paid any attention to you because they always had to go find me. They had to go figure out if I was still alive. They had to go take that phone call in the middle of the night and go bail me out of jail. I never paid any attention to you and your sweet, loving little girl. And on top of that, I robbed you. I robbed the house one time. I knew Mom and Dad kept everything in a safe, so I broke into the house and I robbed the house, and all I could find was your piggy bank, and I took your $60, and I wanted to give you the $60 back, and I wanted to repay you that $60 and tell you about how wrong I was and ask you if there's anything I can ever do to make it right. And my little baby sister, she looked at me and she said, it was 61. Right? And what happened was that in that moment, I realized that she'd held on to that $61 for a very long time. I realized that what we're doing here is freeing up her. I'm freeing up my family, the people I love, so they don't have to have resentments, so they can have forgiveness in their hearts. So that all those years that she was ashamed and embarrassed of who her sister was, and she held on to that $61. She told me how she earned it. And I listened to that. It's my job. I went and I found my two little girls. They're actually camping in New Jersey, and I flew in from out west, and I found them at a rest stop, at a campground, and I told them, I said, hi, my name's Robbie, and I'm your mom. And I was wondering if I could have a minute of your time, so I kind of hijacked them, but sponsors said I could. It was an amends I really wanted to make, and what I did was I was able to sit down with them for a minute before the police got there, as well on there. And I was allowed to tell them how wrong I was. But I don't know how wrong I was. See, because I wasn't there. I was a blackout drinker. I had a good mom. She didn't abandon me. I had no idea what I'd done to them. So I asked them to tell me a little bit about it. Tell me everything about it. Told them I'd do anything I could to make it better. But I would never hear from them again after that conversation for a very long time. They showed up at my doorstep about, what was that, Jess, like 3 months ago? I caught Jess trying to smoke. 3 months ago? They showed up at my doorstep about 3 months ago. They said the same thing to me. I'm Cassandra and I'm Jackie and I'm your daughters. And Cassandra said, I'm about to give birth to this baby and I'm scared. And I wanted to know my mom before I did. I wanted to know who my mom is before I became a mom. I wanted to find you and I wanted to have a conversation with you. She stayed with me. She didn't need anything. I mean, she did. She, you know, she's me. She's 23 and whatever and has no money, no idea where to live and pregnant and stuff like that. And because of you, I was able to be there when she showed up. Not just sober, but wide awake and spiritually fit to be there when she showed up. And because you gave that to me again, right? You taught me that. And when she showed up, we had real amends conversations, right? She told me what it was like to grow up without a mom. And I took that. I take that from her. I tell her, you don't own that anymore. I want to take all that from you. Tell me. They told me what it was like to grow up in an alcoholic family with a mom that abandoned them, to be made fun of when they were kids, to have nobody talk to about boys. And I listened to that, and I told her, it's all absolutely true. I did all those things that you heard about. And I'd do anything to make it better. She just gave birth to this little baby boy, Brendan B. Ray. I was just showing some pictures, getting him out for the girls, and he's beautiful. That makes me a grandma, by the way. And that's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, these 12 steps and what the book has taught me, right? And so these people come back. The book says that sometimes their families never come back. You told me 14 years ago it was on God's time and I couldn't make it happen, but you would help me live without shame, remorse, and guilt, and that's what I did. When they showed up at my doorstep, I was able to look them in the eye. No shame, remorse, and guilt. We were just able to talk and show up for each other, and it's beautiful. I went to my mom and I told her that I was wrong and how can I make it better? She slammed the door on me. She said, you've been lying to me your whole life. Get out. I don't believe anything comes out of your mouth. Never have, never will. And then she, what happened was I went and told you that. I said, I made my amends to my mom like you told me to, and she didn't accept it. And they said, that's okay. That's okay. Most people are going to see it through the actions, not the words, right? Bill W. once said, and it wasn't original from him, but he once said, carry the message using words as a last resort only. We carry the message out there in our actions. We make God look good, not ourselves sound good up here, right? We're out there carrying the message. My mom saw the actions throughout the years, and it took a long time, and she started to come around, and she joined me in this journey, and we walked hand in hand together on a spiritual journey together, and she became my best friend, and I was able to take her to places like Montreal with my career today. I would travel all over the country, and I would take my mom with me, and we would explore these places, and we'd go in these big cathedrals and just pray together and be together, and it was a beautiful life. She loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and she loved Al-Anon, and if there's, you know, any Al-Anons in the room, I thank God for you. It saved my mom's life. My mom suffered greatly from my alcoholism, and if it wasn't for Al-Anon, she would not know where to bring it, where to take it. And what happened was, in November, she got real sick. Recently, she was 59 years old. She got cancer. She got real sick. And you guys came to me. The girls that I sponsor and my girlfriends, you all came to me and you said, you know what? We're going to be with the twins. We're going to stay here. Why don't you go see your mom? You need to be with your mom right now. And that was, again, Alcoholics Anonymous showed up, took care of my kids so I could go be with my mom. And I held her hand and I laid in her bed for 10 days as she died at home, just me and her, and she passed away, and I held her hand and I rubbed her cheek, and as she took her last breath, I said, it's okay, Mom, go with God, it's okay. And she'd say, Robbie, I'm scared, just hold my hand. And she finally took that last breath and she left. And I got up and I called the morgue and I said, can you come pick my mom up? This is a dress, we're in her living room. And then I called you guys. And I said, I called my friend Ricky D. He said, what's going on? I said something I never said before. I said, my mom's dead. She's passed away. She's gone. They're coming to get her body. Can you talk to me for a minute? I said, sure. I was at work. I'll go outside. We talked about God and the grace of God and how beautiful the experience was and the most beautiful spiritual experience I've ever had, right? And how I got to be there for her in the end and take care of her. We made amends and we had beautiful conversations and there was no regrets and no resentments left and it was beautiful. And I came home and you all helped me plan a memorial service and you held my hand and you were there for me. And that's what we do. And for that, again, I cannot be grateful enough. I can't tell you. The love that I feel for my creator, to feel like I'm walking in the sunlight of the spirit, even with mom passed away, right? I come home and I always talk about this. I heard this prayer one time and Mari G from Canada says this. She says the takeaway prayer, right? And I said, God, I said, take away from me everything you don't want me to have. And I started saying this prayer for a while. You have to mean it deep down in your heart, right? What happened was with some years of being around here and I was falling asleep a little bit. This is before my mom passed. What happened was that hadn't happened, right? God started to take away things for me, you know, and the boyfriend that I really thought I liked and stuff like that, you know, he had to go. And I just kept saying this prayer, okay, take away everything that you don't want me to have. And the boyfriend left and I got laid off from my job. And if I wasn't laid off, I wouldn't have been with my mom those 10 days. I would have had a job to go to. And when the boyfriend left, I started picking new meetings. Because I didn't want to go to those meetings anymore, and I found you guys. I found solution-based big book meetings where the spirit was alive and awake and these pockets of enthusiasm, and you guys were on fire, and I got to be around you. And I would not feel like I'm walking in the sunlight of the spirit in a new and wonderful world after my mom passed if I didn't have you. And that's how God works. That's how the God in my life works anyway. In 10, 11, and 12, see, in 10, I get to watch for character defects to crop up, and I ask God to remove them as soon as I see them. That doesn't mean, hey, I've been a jerk for 5 days, somebody help me. It means, you know what, I'm starting to feel a little jealous here, and God, can you remove it? Pick up the phone and discuss it with another human being at once. Make amends promptly and directly at once if I've done wrong, and then turn my thoughts to somebody who can help. How easy is that? We've designed for living. There is a solution. It tells exactly how to live day by day. It tells us upon awakening. And it tells us what do we do when we go to sleep. We take our inventory. Upon awakening, the book knew that I suffered from self-pity. And it said every day, wake up and ask God to remove and divorce you from self-pity. Right? The book knew that already about me. So the book gives me a design for living, a solution, a way of life in which I can now live. Right? And so I get to take that inventory, and it says that we have entered into a world of the spirit, and I'm running out of time. So that's 10 and 11 keeps me hooked up, and it keeps me hooked up with God and you, and it keeps me hooked up with God's children, right? And Dave Perry talks about if you're not feeling close to God, just get closer to his children. That's all he wants. Do his work. Perform it well. Get closer to his children. I fall in love with the God in you. You fall in love with the God in each other. And I see you guys falling in love with each other. And it's beautiful. I see you guys going out there and doing things for other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, going out of your way when it's inconvenient. They told me, my sponsor tells me all the time, AA only counts when it's inconvenient. Don't count if you want to do it. It's when you want to go to sleep. And that girl calls and she wants to talk and it's 2 o'clock in the morning. It's when you want to go hang out with him. And the girl calls and she needs a ride to a meeting and she's jammed up. This is when we do the work. And I guess I'm out of time, huh? I always run over, but we got the 12. Undescribably wonderful, the book talks about. That's pretty much sums up my life today. I wake up with purpose. I ask God to direct me in where I can be useful and maximum service to others. I thank you for being a part of this journey. And that's all I have. Thank you.
The group would like to thank Robbie. Thanks for coming up, Robbie. Share this message of hope. Thank you very much.